Playback on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Dublin Airport's Airport Club. Make travel effortless with lounge access, stress-free parking, fast-track security and exclusive duty-free savings.
Good morning. It started with a little present of a jet from the Qatari royal family. A luxury jet. Is there any other kind? The Boeing 747-8 came in at a cool $400 million. Sure, only a fool would say no.
I would never be one to turn down that kind of an offer. I mean, I could be a stupid person and say, no, we don't want a free, very expensive airplane. But I thought it was a great gesture. And I think it was a gesture because of the fact that we have helped and continue to. We will continue to. All of those countries, Saudi Arabia, UAE, Qatar, and others, we keep them safe. If it wasn't for us, they probably wouldn't exist right now. And I think this was just a gesture of good faith.
Do you plan to use the plane after you leave office?
No, I don't. No, it would go directly to the library after I leave office. I wouldn't be using it.
And lo, Donald Trump kicked off the first major overseas tour of his presidency in the Middle East. And make no mistake, this was all about business. On Morning Ireland, Mary spoke to Greg Carlstrom, Middle East correspondent with The Economist.
Is the acceptance of this plane, and I want to talk to you about the trip to these Middle East countries, but is it another example and perhaps showing us where he's going this week, another example of a president who mixes the politics with the business, the global with the personal?
It is, and it's not the only example of that that we will see this week, I suspect. Trump, since he took office, has been expanding his family's business dealings with Gulf countries. They've signed various contracts to build or to license Trump Towers in Saudi Arabia, in the UAE, other countries in the region. His sons are getting very involved with various cryptocurrency firms that do business in the UAE. We've seen a lot of mixing of family business and state business already, and accepting this plane, I think, would just be the latest example of it.
And President Trump was bringing with him quite the entourage.
The guest list, the leaders of Amazon, NVIDIA, OpenAI, Uber, Coca-Cola, Google, Boeing, and on and on and on, as well as Tesla and SpaceX owner Elon Musk in the administration, of course, lining up to meet him.
The him in question, Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. And those handshakes and photo ops only helping his reputational rehabilitation. Claire spoke to Chief Correspondent of Feature Story News, Simon Marks.
These pictures speak volumes about the bounce back that Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman of Saudi Arabia has enjoyed. It is complete following the disgrace and shame and opprobrium that was heaped on him following the murder in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul of Saudi American journalist Jamal Khashoggi. All of that now seemingly forgotten by this US government, as it was largely forgotten by the Biden administration in the back half of Joe Biden's period.
And certainly deals were being struck. A $600 billion investment deal with Saudi Arabia, which included agreements on tech, AI, infrastructure, healthcare, and a $127 billion arms deal. An eye-wateringly large figure. With Gavin, Nabi Boulos, Middle East Bureau Chief for the LA Times.
Is a $600 billion deal credible?
Well, so that's a good question. The fact of the matter is, if we consider the past situation during Trump's first term, when we talked about $350 billion of deals, that amount, I'm told by quite a few economic experts, is actually not realistic even then, which is to say that actually the number of deals that were realized from that initial amount was less than 350. Indeed, it's said to be in about the $100 billion range. With that being said, I mean, there's no doubt that there will be an increase in Saudi investment in the U.S. At the same time, just to put this in perspective, let's say that we're talking about $600 billion for the next 4 years of Trump's presidency. That's an average of $150 billion a year. That is about 15% of Saudi's GDP, assuming it remains at the same level. And that simply is not a realistic figure. I mean, I'm right now standing inside a center which is showing all the different mega projects that Saudi Arabia is engaging in. These will cost a lot of money. And it would amaze me, I must say, if the Saudi economy could be reoriented in such a wholesale fashion to be or basically supporting the US in such a complete way. And that just doesn't seem possible to me, I must say.
And Trump also announced that the US would ease sanctions against Syria. In Damascus, celebrations. And for Syrian President Ahmed al-Shara, a diplomatic U-turn. On Wednesday's News at One, Rachel spoke to Stephen Kalin, foreign correspondent with the Wall Street Journal.
This is also a significant turnaround for Ahmed al-Shara, who once led a branch of al-Qaeda.
That's true. It was really a striking image coming out of Riyadh this morning to see, a former al-Qaeda Islamic State leader shaking hands with the president of the United States. And I think that is comes on the back of a lot of lobbying by the Saudi Crown Prince and the president of Turkey to try to convince Donald Trump that this was the right move. And it's also created a lot of criticism. And there's a lot of people who are anxious and skeptical that he has, that Ahmed al-Shara has really taken a turn away from that radical past.
And if Trump's stated aim was to make deals and get investment, well, how was it going? Later that day, Sarah put this to economist journalist Gareth Brown.
How is this 4-day Middle East trip visit being seen, do you think? Thus far, a success?
I think it's been a huge success. I mean, I think one country which we'll be looking on very closely is Iran. Sort of very delicate negotiations playing out between Iran and the Americans. You know, they were in Italy and speaking in Oman as well. And I think the Iranians will be looking at what's just happened to Syria and Ahmed al-Shara, where the US has lifted sanctions. We know Iran is under its own sanctions, and they can maybe take a lesson from that. Like, President Trump is a man who, if you can strike a deal with him, if you can please him, then the lifting of sanctions is possible. Mm. So I think so far everyone involved is pretty happy, and the Iranians will be watching closely to get a better read on President Trump.
And Donald Trump ended his tour by signing a massive AI data centre project deal with United Arab Emirates. Now, even though he'd spent 4 days in the Middle East, President Trump was quite markedly not visiting Israel. On the News at One, Rachel put this to Borzu Dargahi, international correspondent with The Independent.
He isn't visiting Israel. How significant is that?
I think it is significant. I think it points to a certain sensitivity that Trump has developed in his second term, the idea that he is a pawn of Israel, that has very much rankled him. He has fired, or rather demoted, one of his officials who turned out to be making secret deals with Netanyahu behind his back. He has shown himself to be sensitive to the claim that his government is infiltrated by very much pro-Israeli operatives. And that has rankled him this time around. He doesn't want to be seen as being anyone's toy.
This visit comes, though, as the UN warns that Gaza is on the verge of famine. So will Arab leaders be pressing him to put more pressure on Israel?
They definitely will, especially Qatar. This is even for Qatar is diplomatically vested and has ties with both Hamas and Turkey, which has ties to Hamas. It is very much invested in peace in the Gaza and in the Middle East. But all these rulers are under pressure by their own people. This is Israel is a highly sensitive topic in the Arab world. Even in these Gulf autocracies, it is a sore topic. And there will be no peace, there will be no real peace between the Arab world and Israel until this Palestinian issue is resolved.
And this week again, bombing in Gaza and renewed calls for the end to the aid blockade for the people there. Yesterday, Claire spoke to James Elder of UNICEF.
There was this fear that as soon as Donald Trump left the Middle East, that there would be an uptick in the Israeli attacks. But we saw on Tuesday night that there was a huge bombing. Then we had that order for people to leave the Rimmel neighbourhood of Gaza. So what's your sense of it? This huge operation that has been promised from Israel, do you think it's already begun?
Look, I don't have any military expertise. I can only link to what people on the ground are telling me. And there has been a massive escalation now. This is the most severe 48 hours
Whether it's that in terms of bombardments, that would need to know how many bombs have dropped, but certainly in terms of numbers of children killed for UNICEF, there's absolutely no doubt, since those first days after the ceasefire broke. So the evidence on the ground, the evidence again of what women and children are enduring right now is very clear, that speaks to a heavy escalation of fighting.
And he gave this harrowing description of what people in Gaza are facing.
What are your teams telling you about what is happening now?
Well, what's happening now, we have levels of starvation. We have the risk of famine again, remembering that there are hundreds of trucks across a border. There are people in comfortable restaurants 30 miles away. But yeah, long-term damage lasts a lifetime. It's cognitive decline. It's poor health. It's a whole generation, and it's permanent. But right now, what's happening is levels of starvation. That's not a natural disaster. It's inflicted. It's a slow, it's a cruel process. It's where the body eats first its fat, then its muscle. And if you're looking at a child, they grow cold, they grow emotionally numb, they stop crying, and that is your moment where you start to then see death. And so somehow, a blockade, more than 2 months, and I'm talking to colleagues this morning on the ground, and they're hearing what they think are bunker bombs, relentless tank fire, and more than 2 months of not a single drop of water, Claire. It's, look, blockades, bombings, children starving, somehow this has been normalised. So we are at the most critical point for Gaza, and we've said that before, but somehow it eclipses it. But right now, yes, if we're looking at potentially a ground offensive, this is the moment that every person in Gaza who is still alive has absolutely feared.
James Elder of UNICEF with Claire yesterday. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Deep breath, team playback, doing a little bit of sport. Well, you would have to when legends make the decision to dismount.
And here's Joanne Cantwell.
Thank you, Cormac. Hello. As you can expect, that news of Rachel Blackmore's retirement as a professional jockey is drawing tributes from all over, with an Taoiseach Micheál Martin calling her a sports person of a generation. Stable jockey with Henry de Bromhead, who once described her as an incredible person and an incredible jockey. She's a Grand National winner, leading rider at Cheltenham Festival, Gold Cup champion, hurdle champion, chase winner, the first woman to achieve all that and so much more.
Breaking news on Monday, and Rachel Blackmore had spoken to Brendan at the weekend, and she told him about pretty much growing up on horseback.
And how old were you when you got on a pony first?
I'd say I must have been, there's photos there of when I was 2 or 3. My older brother, Johnny, had a pony before me, so I was so lucky, like I never had to ask for a pony. There was just one there. So had a fantastic childhood in that sense. We were wheeled around the country riding when we were younger, and we had a great time.
No, the pony that the girl has in the book is a bit of a gore, yeah?
That's 100%. Factual.
Is it?
That's Bubbles. She was my kind of first pony, we'll say, I had off lead rein and stuff, and she was really forward going, and she loved going too fast, I suppose. But I think that maybe gave me a sense of what that was like, and I didn't not like it. So maybe she kind of instilled a career I was going to have without me even knowing it.
Yeah. And when did you decide you wanted to be a jockey then? How old?
Yeah, I suppose I always knew, like I had an interest in racing kind of growing up. I would have, the Grand National was the first race I would have watched as a kid growing up. And, I always knew I wanted to be a jockey and do it as an amateur and whatnot. But I never thought I'd be able to actually make a career out of it. So, it's kind of mad how everything has happened.
And on Sunday evening, a new programme, Dunn Talking. The Dunn in question, Bernard Dunn. And he kicked off the series with fellow boxer Kelly Harrington and this story of her very first fight.
I was only boxing 3 months, and they got me a fight with a girl from Cavan who was boxing for about 3 years. And I gets into the ring, everybody wants to be a boxer until they get hit in the face. Like, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
My chin was up in the air, my hands were low, and I was like literally on me toes bouncing around the ring. I hit her, boom, boom, 1-2, straight down the pipe, and says, sorry. And then she comes back and she levels me over. And
She didn't apologise, did she?
She didn't apologise, no. But it got stopped and I bawled my eyes out all the way home. And mainly because my ego, because I was after being bashed, because I thought like it would have been a grand old fight, But I was after getting my ass handed to me. And the fact it stopped 10 seconds before the last bell, like, just destroyed me. The secretary, who wouldn't let me into the club for nearly that whole year, he says to me, "Well, love, what do you think of that?" And I was like, "I'm sorry, yeah." And he goes, "Well, we probably won't see you back in the club now, will we?" And I was like, "I'll be back tomorrow." And then that was it then. Like, I just kept training.
But it was the encouragement of the coaches in her club that kept her coming back.
Personally, I think boxing clubs don't get the credit that they deserve, especially in disadvantaged communities, because it saves so many Absolutely. Kids from going down that wrong street. There's times I'd have a good spar, the coaches would say, "Great spar, Kelly, look forward to seeing you on Wednesday." I'd leave that club 10 foot tall, do you know what I mean? And I couldn't wait to get back Wednesday then, because someone was at the saying I was great. They gave me confidence and I just couldn't wait to get back. And that was what I wanted, like, that was the addiction. It was just wanting to go back and improve every single time. So instead of a bad addiction, I got a good addiction, and that was going and improving every day.
Kelly Harrington on Done Talking. And on Arena, a call for hope and in praise of quiet activism in what often feels like a volatile and slightly scary world. No Straight Road Takes You There, Essays for Uneven Terrain, is the latest book from Rebecca Solnit. In her sights are climate crisis, feminism, democracy and the rest. She's coming to the International Literature Festival Dublin, and before we get too carried away, she did give us her definition of hope.
I would be happy to be called hopeful as long as we distinguish hopeful from optimistic. I always say optimism, like pessimism and doomerism, assumes we know exactly what's going to happen, which means it's preordained and nothing is required of us. Whereas hope is just a sense of possibilities and therefore a responsibility to seize them and try and realize the best ones and forestall the worst ones.
And she invited us to take a slightly longer perspective, because maybe we're actually getting just a little bit better than we were.
Talk to us a little bit about that idea of long-sightedness and what exactly you mean by that.
I see so much despair and defeatism, a sense we never change anything or nothing will ever change. You know, the world is static or maybe just deteriorating. Comes from a kind of amnesia, a lack of memory just over anybody's lifetime who's more than a quarter century old. When did marriage equality pass? And in your country, abortion rights. And, you know, so I feel like I see time in bigger chunks, partly as somebody who reads a lot, somebody who's talked to older people, somebody who's just wildly enthused about knowing and tracing these long trajectories of change. There was a period where people liked to tell me that feminism had achieved nothing, which is an astonishingly clueless thing to say if you have any idea of what the status of women was in, say, 1960, how radically different women are in much of the world now in terms of rights, equality, participation in civil society, government, education, law, medicine, and everything else. And so the long perspective gives you power. Memory is a superpower, and it's available to almost all of us, but not particularly encouraged by social media and a lot of the discourse around us.
And she talked to Sean about activism and advocacy, often a slow process, even a slog, but with the possibility of what she called success without victory.
There's so many ways that things can have an impact, a good and useful impact, that are not necessarily the short-term immediate, we demanded it on Tuesday and we got it on Wednesday, which often seems like a lot of people's criterion for victory, which leaves a lot of people disappointed when it doesn't work quite like that. Not that I have anything against short, simple, immediate, and obvious. It's just not necessarily how change works. And understanding the slower, more complex, less predictable ways and all the glorious indirect consequences, and sometimes the terrible ones, I think is part of just understanding change so we can participate in it.
Fascinating. That was Rebecca Solnit with Sean. And on Monday, Dermot Whelan was in for Oliver and he spoke to singer Julie Feeney. Now, she's just been appointed Dunleary Rathdown Musician in Residence. But much of their interview was about the 5 years that Feeney had spent caring for her mother who had Alzheimer's. And while she said there were moments of connection and joy, there were times when her mother struggled to recognise her.
I mean, I remember the first time that happened, and it was a bit of a blow. But then I realised I actually didn't care about that. I wasn't concerned in any way, and she didn't disappear for me really at all. And I know she does for a lot of people, and they find that. Mm. For me, she didn't disappear. She was the same person. I just saw the more beautiful sides to her. I saw the quirkier sides. I didn't realise she was as quirky. I knew she was always hilariously funny.
Yeah,
but she had to hold her station so well in her life as a principal teacher, and she'd six of us through college and everything. I got to see that beautiful side. So I think that for me, I found that she'd always say right to the very end, "Julie, where's Julie? Where's Julie? Where's Julie?" You know, and somebody said, "And who's Julie?" And she went, "Me sister, me pal, me child." You know, like it was kind of like one. You know, and I thought that was. Like kind of, it didn't matter. It was just like the person, you know what I mean? Yeah. The person that she was with. And I think what's the difficult thing is, I think it's more difficult for me that she's gone, to be honest, than kind of to see her. Because I know it's a very difficult and very challenging for people when they say that the person isn't there anymore. I completely understand how they say that. For me, I just found just such a beauty. The beauty inside her, I learned so much from her, and she taught me so much too. Like it's about patience. You know the way that I've became patient. I don't think I was patient before. Your patience, whatever about patience being challenged as a parent, I just found as being a carer, your patience is just like, you just have to leave it out. Just leave it all flat. You have to become, you know, kind of zen about it.
And Julie Feeney was honest about the difficult times too and talked about the small acts of kindness she had encountered.
I remember I was down on a street and I was trying to manage the two of them on their own, which was really rewarding for the little ones as well. Obviously, I know it sounds a bit hardcore to like kind of, you know, a bit of an intense situation, but I was down on the street and it was mayhem. I mean, there was people trying to get out of the car, get into the car and go over here and go over there. You know, I was trying to manage them all. And this woman just appeared. She was about, I'd say, 70. She had grey hair. Just appeared outside the window and she just went, "It's going to be okay." Just her window, her face just appeared like a ghost completely outside the window. And I went, "Thanks, thanks," you know. Yeah. And I've never seen her again or, you know, but she just, so you do remember those moments.
And Dermot Whelan's own mother had dementia and he talked about their relationship.
I remember after I visited my mum, because it was emotionally tough, I used to go and have like a power cry in the car afterwards.
Yeah.
Just to sort of release that's built up. There's everything going on. There's frustration, there's sadness, there's confusion, you know, and I just found that a little sort of steering wheel cry for about 30 seconds would sort of allow me to move on.
Apparently it's 90 seconds.
Really?
Yeah, apparently it's 90 seconds. And that's one of the things with grief that I've tried to do is like when you're so afraid to go there because it's so horrible. Physiologically, now I know the experts out there can tell me, but I kind of tried it out. And actually, if you let it out for it's 90 seconds and then it's kind of, you know, it's like a reset or something. I mean, that is really, it was definitely a thing. And it was great, exactly as you said.
But you do have these strange moments of sort of beauty in there, don't you?
Like, oh my God.
Because my mum grew up in Rossmuck in Connemara. So her Irish started to come back to her.
Oh my goodness, you're from...
And she's, her love of traditional Irish music came back to her. So she loved going to a pub and hearing live trad music. And it just so lifted her. But she always was a very sort of plain eater, never watched sports, didn't drink beer. But there was one stage where she used to watch rugby with me and drink beer and eat spicy chicken wings. And we'd have the best time. It was just this sort of interesting period in the... you know, throughout the dementia, where that was just a little window. And those little moments can be really precious, you know.
Julie Feeney talking to Dermot Whelan in for Oliver on Monday. And the man himself on Thursday spoke to Pat McCabe. And McCabe's new novel is called Golden Grove. And again, a conversation about the nature of memory and meaning.
The novel, because it's clearly about memory, isn't it? Because this guy is looking back at memory. And Pogue Mahone was about memory in terms of Alzheimer's. And that it was in the family, wasn't it? And it affected yourself and Margot, your artist wife.
Yes.
Very significantly. It is sort of in this novel as well, isn't it?
Well, it's a thing that has affected so many families, you know, the as we grow older, remain older, and having experienced it close hand, I suppose it always seeps into your writing, that kind of, what is the nature of memory? Are we all just an agglomeration of things that happened to us? And if you take those away, what do you become? And it leads you to notions of the immortal soul, doesn't it? I mean, now that, you know, I mean, that, all these things are back in the air, you know, with the Pope, and you see the extraordinary kind of gathering. People are concerned about these things now in Gaza, you know. What are we?
Yeah.
What are we? Are we just consumers? And you get someone close to you like that who doesn't remember your name. Man, you know.
This was your father-in-law.
Yeah.
And you were very close.
Yeah.
What's that like? Is it frightening?
I think it must lead you to prayer, actually, because it's although I'm not particularly religious, but I can understand how people would go on their knees and say, can you help me with this?
You must be religious if you pray.
Nah, I'd like to be, but I'm not.
It doesn't work for you.
Ah, well, it does after a fashion, but I suppose I'm what would be described as a collapsed Catholic.
There's a bit of it still knocking around, it sounds like.
I hope so.
Do you think about it yourself, the existence and the future?
Well, as the fellow says, you wouldn't be much of a writer if you didn't, would you? Because, I mean, why do you do it anyway, sit in a room making up all these stories about people that don't exist? It's some kind of form of... And then Joyce said, you know, you lower the pail into the well of the subconscious and see what it brings up, you know. So obviously you have to lower the pail into the well of your memory and the memories of all those close to you. Mm. So I think particularly in Ireland with small towns, the family, you're not only telling your own story, but you're telling the story of your town, your county, your country, your identity, all that stuff.
Always so interesting. Pat McCabe with Oliver. Back in a bit. Welcome back. The sun will come out today, yesterday, tomorrow. The sunshine has been mega. We could get used to it. And you'd be very mean to rub it into your besties. You'd head it off to the supposed sun.
We're looking at temperatures that are going to beat Barcelona in Spain and Athens in Greece. And this happens, doesn't it, once a year or maybe every second year. And we love that. We love the fact that... And you know what we love as well? We love telling people who've just returned from sunnier climes how good the weather's been in their absence. We enjoy that too. We do.
Tourmalinus in the backyard all week it was. But as always, the eye is on the far field. Can it last? And yes, we've posed this question before and got the answer. But if we keep asking, maybe we'll get the answer we want, because that's how science should work.
What about the bigger question, Alan? The rest of the summer.
Alan O'Reilly, Carla Weather with our Katie.
Because I've been told by a colleague that because the oak came out before the ash, or the ash leafed before the oak, that this year is in line for a bumper summer.
Yes, well, ash before oak and oak before ash is an old wives' tale that, you know, last 2 years we did have poor summers and the ash came out first. The oak has come out this year, but the scientific weather supercomputers aren't able to do quite what the oak and the ash can do. So it's very hard to know what's going to happen. The only thing that, and this is not to put a dampener on, okay, before I get into it, but the average amount of rainfall that we see over a year is pretty consistent in Ireland. So, for example, we had a very dry start to April and then we had a very wet end to April. So if we do have a prolonged dry spell, we do normally end up that rainfall falls sometime within the year, give or take, you know, 100 millimetres here or there. So I'd be hopeful that we'd be very unlucky to get three bad summers in a row. But I'm not sure you could hedge any bets on it.
So,
Katie, one part superstition to two parts wishful thinking. But shh, don't anger the sun gods.
The good weather continues. I was talking to somebody today and said, don't hex it.
Don't exit. I was saying it's here for 7 days. Don't say that. Don't say that. As if what I say or what you say or what anybody says can affect the weather. Or maybe it does. Maybe how we say it and what we say does affect the weather.
In which case, we love you. Never leave us. Now, have a listen to this. Bob Dylan covering Shane McGowan.
I take shelter from a shower and I slip to your arm. On a rainy night in the snow, the wind was whistling. I sang you all my song. You told me of your joy. Whatever you love was you are little girl's boy.
Dylan covering the Pogues at the Outlaw Music Festival tour. And as Shane McGowan's sister Siobhan told Sarah, this was really special.
You posted online, it would mean the world to Shane.
Yeah. I think the thing is, a friend, an old friend, journalist Sean O'Hagan, he sent it to me yesterday morning, so it just came out of the blue. And he sent me the video, so I actually haven't been able to listen to Shane's songs, either sung by anybody else or himself, since he passed. But because it was Bob Dylan, I just went, oh, my God, like, because my mind instantly went back to, you know, our rooms when we were young and me 8, 9, him 14, 15, and Bob Dylan blasting out of the room. And also the fact that Shane introduced Bob Dylan to the family, not personally, but through the music. So, in fact, our whole family were discussing Bob Dylan's lyrics in the 70s, you know. And because of that, I thought, God, I actually have to listen to this. You know, I have to steel myself and I have to listen. And I did. And it was just so moving for me to see and hear Bob Dylan singing Shane's words. It was amazing.
Oh, really? Well, thank you for sharing that story with us, because as you say, I can't imagine how difficult it's been and steeling yourself to listen to it. But of all the people you could listen to, I suppose.
How do you think he would have reacted if he had heard this?
I think he would have thought it was brilliant. I think he would have said that Bob's version was fantastic. I love it. I think he would have loved it. I think he would have been stunned and moved, and he probably would have felt the way that I did, that life goes full circle.
From Drive Time on Thursday. And with Ray, a very real robot in Montrose. Yes, I know, the jokes write themselves. Have a listen.
As you know, with live radio, anything can possibly happen.
The capital of Ireland is Dublin, where there are plenty of opportunities to stay active and lead a healthy lifestyle.
Yeah, and that's Deckard, who's just given us the lowdown on Dublin. Thank you very much, Deckard.
Very robot-y. Deckard, born in the Hive Lab at the University of Galway, with Professors Derek O'Keefe and Cornelia Connolly.
So he is a humanoid robot, which means he has arms and legs and he has a head and he acts and moves in a way that Homo sapiens or humans move.
As opposed to something that goes around on wheels or something.
Exactly,
like
a trash can on wheels, or maybe one of those robot vacuum cleaners you have in your house.
Right.
He's more realistic.
I was trying to describe to our listeners how he got up from a lying position. Cornelia, would you describe that, or would you describe
it? He's amazing, isn't he? So literally he's lying flat, then the feet are down, the knees bend, and he just jumps up. It is amusing.
It's like a gymnastic sort of thing.
Yeah, it's very, very lifelike because you know, he has the hands and legs and he just moves in a human-like way.
Now, their aim for Deckard is preventative healthcare, and he might also work well in the classroom.
What we're starting to see are these humanoid robots emerging. There's about 20 companies worldwide producing these robots, so they're going to start to infiltrate into our lives in a very useful way as a tool.
You see, that's an interesting word, isn't it? Infiltrate.
But there's sort of like that's something dark about the word infiltrate, isn't there?
Well, they're never going to replace humans, but they're definitely going to support us, I think, in our behaviours. And so, like in medicine or in education, they'll be there to support populations that need that a little bit of additional support. So whether that's a child learning a new language or learning mathematics. Or indeed, like some people with autism spectrum disorder, it has been proven that robots can support those populations where humans can learn behaviours from the robots. And it's having positive impact.
The Darcy was, well, trepidatious at best. But was there a possibility that Deckard and AI tools might be used for good rather than evil? Certainly, Professor O'Keefe thought so.
A perfect example is radiography. So if an AI looks at a million pictures of an x-ray, and then it can highlight an area that might be of concern. It doesn't know what a human is. It just sees pixels on a piece of paper. And so when people say to me, oh, you're afraid that a robot or AI might take your job, I say, well, like as a clinician, I have 1,000 jobs a week to do. So if it wants to do one of them and it's better than me at it, fair enough. I mean, think about calculators. You know, so they're better at us than math, and we just accept them as part of the tool set that we have.
Yeah, I'm not as hopeful as you are, but I think this is what we're going through now is seismic.
It's a time of change.
Yeah,
it's
tectonic.
It's
bigger than the invention of the calculator, Derek, I feel. Anyway, we will see. Cornelia, thank you very much. Derek, thank you.
Thank you.
Max, Amanda, thank you. And Deckard, thank you very much. Will he say thank you or?
He can say goodbye.
Yeah, go on.
Goodbye, Deckard.
It's going to take some time.
Goodbye, Deckard.
Hello, Deckard. Goodbye, Deckard.
Goodbye.
Hey!
Thank you for having me on your show.
No,
I have enjoyed our time together. Stay healthy and take care.
Thank you. Thanks, Deckard. Thank you.
Oh, the sound of the future. And with Oliver, the fabulously named Foil Arms and Hog.
We have a name that sounds like an old English lawyer's office.
Foil Arms and Hog.
Yeah. And company.
And while they do have actual names, they're not mad for using them. But they did chat about their European tour.
I think Amsterdam is our David Hasselhoff area, though, right? we're just unusually popular there.
Oh, the Hoff. But to get around, they ended up using Dolly Parton's tour bus. As you might expect, the woman travels in style. The entourage, maybe not quite so much.
Lots of rhinestones.
Rhinestones
everywhere.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and mirrors in the shapes of the guitars.
Oh,
yeah,
brilliant. It was quite rock and roll. It definitely looked like it was from the past, shall we say. And so then we go through to the I was like, oh, this is where you're going to sleep. So I open it up and there's like, it was shelves. So I was like, oh, what are the shelves for? And I'm like, no, that's where you sleep. They're the bunks.
For people.
And I was like,
the shelves were the same. Four
bunks.
Four
bunk beds.
Yeah, four bunk beds. And the one at the bottom is like steerage in the Titanic. Like that's, but without the dancing and the crack, like just being sloshed around. And then so I immediately, big lanky fella I am, as I really went to the absolute top. I was like, oh, whatever. And then we discovered, right, there was a door kind of, it was actually halfway down the bus.
Right, yeah.
Oh, there must be more beds behind here.
Oh, yeah.
But there wasn't. We opened that door and there was Hog.
Well, there was one bed, one giant bed.
This is Dolly's quarters.
Dolly's bed was right there with also a bathtub.
On a bus.
An ornate bathtub.
This is amazing.
Yeah.
King size bed and a bathtub.
Oh, but of course, the problem is there are three men in this.
Yeah, you're getting it.
Unfortunately. So, what?
We did rock, paper, scissors for the thing. And Hog got it, you know, is the. I hogged the bed.
For the entire tour.
Well, that's changing sheets, and the sheets from our sardine tin weren't going to fit on his joint king size duvet.
Well, it was a fair rock paper scissors.
And because Hog is an actor, they, as only good friends can, tell stories that slag the almighty out of each other.
I met Hog in college, and I was like, oh, someone goes, you have to check out Hog's, I didn't call him Hog at the time, Sean Flanagan's, IMDb, you know, it's crazy. And I was like, what? The funny guy? Yeah, God, he's been in loads of movies. So I checked it out, right? And I go to him, geez, fair play in the movies. And he's like, what? He actually didn't know what I was talking about. And I was like, you were in movies. And he's like, oh, yeah. And I was like, what? I was like, oh, well, have you seen them? He goes,
one or two of them. I was like, you've never seen the movies you're in. This blew my mind. I felt, from my point of view, if I'd ever been in a movie, I would be like playing it to strangers in the bus. And it, so I found one. I can't remember which one it was, but I showed it to him. I was like, oh, this one, have you ever seen this one? I loved it. I've recently read the book. It's a Dickens one, maybe, it's right?
David Copperfield.
Yeah, David Copperfield. So I go, have you ever seen it? He goes, so I shamed him into buying it and watching it, right? And then I'll let you take over from here, Hug.
So I watched it then. I was like, oh, put on. Oh, yeah, here's that scene, yeah, with Michael Richards and all. He's in it. And then I see me, and it's not my voice. They'd overdubbed me because I couldn't get the accent right. I obviously couldn't get the Cockney accent right.
What?
So they'd use a different dude and never told me. I'm like,
additional dialogue recording. Someone's going
to
cry.
So I totally destroyed this memory for him. And because like, he goes to me, comes to the next area. Well, you know, it's not our, whenever he gets it, it's like, it wasn't even my voice. It's like, what are you talking about? He's like, I remember now the director going, you did it better in the audition. You know, which is like the death knell.
It was awful. How he's
cruel. Now, they are on the go since 2008, and interestingly, split all the money they each make from solo gigs, even the ones you can never escape.
Things like obviously the McDonald's curry ad, which has haunted you forever.
Yes.
They got great value out of that.
Actually, weirdly enough, no one, the only place I ever get recognised for that is in Chippers by the people, staff behind the counter.
Because they're watching.
Yeah, so I went in after a few points one night. Seriously, it's the only place. And but I went in and I said, I'll get a bag of chips. And then it came with a bag of chips and some curry sauce. And I was like, I didn't order that. And I looked up and they're all laughing. The other place was the airport, where a fella in Dublin Airport searched my entire bag. It took like 15 minutes and he said, just want to make sure there was no curry sauce in there. Like the whole thing. Delay me for my flight just for the gag. I actually had to applaud.
That's pretty good.
And with Claire yesterday, somebody had escaped their morning slot.
Hello. Once upon a time I was falling apart. Now I'm only falling in love.
A Shea Byrne-shaped studio invasion to ask the big questions.
What is a power ballad? Is it rock? I think it's rock.
Soft rock.
Soft rock. I think it is the Big Hair, the Bouffant, the Poison.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the One Who Wants. I'm the One. All those kind of things. I love all that stuff. Bon Jovi.
It has to have the big guitar riff, doesn't it, in the middle as well.
That is the key.
Where we can all feel our emotions for a moment.
You feel like you want to take something up, like a hairbrush or a bottle of Ballygown, and sing into it. And I felt right when I was doing that.
Or mime, if you want to be safer. Now, we have one here from the 90s. Let's hear this.
It's a microphone moment. Here we go.
Come on.
I can't see that. I don't want to fall. You see, that's what happens.
I go too high.
And I don't want to miss. You see people, you hold it, you it, and your hand goes and the microphone goes up like this. Let's see. Come on, Claire.
So Armageddon. Claire. Armageddon was a film. Listen, I am not singing on this program. You put me in terrible. The last time you were on, the clip of us chair dancing was everywhere, and we're going to mind ourselves now. Here, we're not singing power ballads
mime with them,
by
bottle.
Aerosmith.
You could mime. You could mime.
I could mime. I think that was the last one.
For God's sake.
And that is it from this week's Playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week, and never let it be said that we would pass up an opportunity for this. Go on, let yourself go.
Turn around. Every now and then I get a little bit lonely, and you're never coming around. Turn around. Every now and then I get a little bit tired of listening to the sound of my tears.
Turn around.
Every now and then I get a little bit nervous that the best of all the years have gone by.
Turn around.